Picture this. You're a college student. It's 4 a.m. and you hear your roommate upstairs saying, "There's someone here." Not unusual, right? Maybe she brought someone home? Then you hear crying. A man's voice saying, "It's okay. I'm going to help you." Still not necessarily alarming. Could be comforting a drunk friend. But then you see him. A figure in black, about 5'10", bushy eyebrows, walking past your door toward the back exit. And something feels wrong. Dylan Mortensen went back to her room and locked the door. 6 hours later, she'd learned that decision allegedly saved her life. I'm Tony Bruschi, and this is the Our Look Back on How We Got Here in the case against Brian Koberger, a 10-part series about four college students one night in November and an investigation that would reveal just how much digital breadcrumbs we all leave behind. Moscow, Idaho is a college town in the northern part of the state, home to the University of Idaho. It's the kind of place where violent crime is extraordinarily rare. According to FBI crime statistics, Leta County, where Moscow is located, typically reports 0 to 2 homicides per year. The last time the area experienced anything approaching this level of violence was decades ago. The University of Idaho dominates the town's identity. Founded in 1889, it's the state's land-grant institution and the primary economic driver for the region. Students make up a significant portion of the population, and when they're gone during breaks, Moscow feels noticeably quieter. November 13th, 2022 was a Sunday. The day before, the University of Idaho Vandals had won their final home football game of the season, defeating UC Davis 34-23. According to local news reports, students had been celebrating throughout the weekend, and the bars and restaurants around campus had been busier than usual. Four friends were about to become the center of one of the most documented murder investigations in Idaho's recent history. But before we get to that night, let me introduce you to them properly, because they were real people with real lives, real dreams, and real families who loved them. Kaylee Gonsalves was 21 years old, a senior from Rathdrum, Idaho, a small town about 90 minutes north of Moscow. According to her family's public statements and social media posts, Kaylee was studying general studies and was close to graduation. Her family has described her as outgoing and determined, someone who made friends easily and maintained those friendships over time. Kaylee had a dog named Murphy, a golden retriever mix, who was well known around the house on King Road. According to roommates and friends, Murphy was energetic and playful, the kind of dog who made noise and demanded attention. This detail becomes relevant later because the sounds Dylan Mortensen heard that night were initially attributed to Kaylee playing with Murphy. Madison Mogan, also 21, was Kaylee's best friend and roommate. She was from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, about an hour north of Moscow. According to family statements provided to media, Madison and Kaylee had known each other since they were in sixth grade, the kind of childhood friendship that survives the transition to college and often lasts a lifetime. Family members have described Madison as someone who was thoughtful and caring, the type of person who remembered birthdays and checked in on friends when they were having difficult times. She was studying marketing, according to university records, and working while finishing her degree. Ethan Chapin was 20 years old, a freshman from Conway, Washington. Conway is a tiny town in Skagit County, population less than 1,000 people. According to his family statements to media, Ethan was studying recreation, sport, and tourism management. He was in his first year at the University of Idaho, still adjusting to college life and making new friends. Family members have described Ethan as someone who brought positive energy wherever he went. His fraternity brothers at Sigma Chi, according to statements they made to media, remembered him as someone who was always willing to help others and who had a natural ability to make people laugh. Zana Kernodle was also 20, a junior from Post Falls, Idaho, which is just across the state line from Spokane, Washington. According to university records, she was studying marketing. Post Falls was larger than the other hometowns with about 35,000 people, but still small enough that everyone knows everyone. According to court documents and witness statements, Ethan and Zana were dating. He frequently stayed at the house on King Road where she lived, often enough that He was essentially a regular resident, even though he wasn't officially on the lease. Now let's talk about the house itself, because its layout and location become crucial to understanding what happened that night. 1122 King Road sits in a neighborhood that's popular with University of Idaho students. It's close enough to campus to walk or bike, but far enough away to feel like you're living off campus rather than in a dorm. The house is a three-story structure that was converted into student housing. According to the lease documents referenced in court filings, six people were authorized to live there. The layout is somewhat unusual, which becomes important to the story. The first floor housed Dylan Mortensen and Bethany Funk. The second floor contained the main living areas, kitchen, living room, and Zana Kernodal's bedroom. The third floor had bedrooms for Kaylee and Madison. There was also a sliding glass door on the second floor that opened onto a deck and provided access to the backyard. This layout meant that sounds from the upper floors might not always be clearly heard on the first floor, depending on what was happening and how the sound traveled through the house. It also meant that someone entering through the sliding glass door would have access to the second and third floors without necessarily alerting anyone on the first floor. Here's what we know happened on the night of November 12th to 13th, 2022. Based on the official timeline released by the Moscow Police Department, witness statements contained in court documents and digital evidence that was later analyzed by investigators. The evening started normally, the way Saturday nights often do in college towns across America. According to the police timeline, Kaylee and Madison went to the Corner Club, a bar in downtown Moscow. This is an establishment that's popular with university students, the kind of place where you go to meet friends and celebrate the end of another week. Meanwhile, Ethan and Zana attended a party at the Sigma Chi fraternity house. According to witness statements contained in court documents, this was a typical fraternity party, loud music, socializing, the kind of gathering that happens on college campuses every weekend. At some point during the evening, both groups made the decision to head home. According to the Moscow Police Department's official timeline, both pairs returned to 1122 King Road around 1:45 a.m. on November 13th. But before they got home, Kaylee and Madison made a stop that would later provide crucial evidence for investigators. At approximately 1:40 a.m., surveillance cameras captured them at a food truck downtown. This food truck, known locally as the Grub Truck, operates late hours specifically to serve students who are leaving bars and parties. The surveillance footage shows Kaylee and Madison ordering food and interacting normally with other customers. They appear to be in good spirits, behaving like college students who have been drinking but are not impaired to the point of concern. This footage would later be analyzed frame by frame by investigators looking for any signs of someone following them or paying unusual attention to them. After getting their food, they received a ride home from what Moscow police described as a private party, meaning someone they knew personally, not a commercial rideshare service. Police have stated that this person was quickly identified and eliminated as a suspect. Ethan and Zana also returned to the house around 1:45 a.m., according to the police timeline. The exact method of their transportation hasn't been detailed in public documents, but they arrived at approximately the same time as Kaylee and Madison. At this point, four people were in the house, Kaylee and Madison, who went to the third floor, and Ethan and Zana, who went to Zana's second floor bedroom. Two other residents were also present. Dylan Mortensen and Bethany Funk, both of whom were on the first floor. For the next couple of hours, according to digital evidence that investigators later analyzed, normal late-night college activities took place. People used their phones, possibly watched videos, and generally wound down from the evening's activities. The digital evidence becomes crucial here because it provides precise timestamps for when people were alive and active. According to the probable cause affidavit, at 4 a.m., Zana placed an order through DoorDash, a food delivery service. This order was successfully completed, meaning Zana was awake, coherent, and able to interact with the delivery person when the food arrived. Phone records analyzed by investigators show that Zana was active on TikTok at 4:12 a.m. This means she was not only awake, but actively using social media, scrolling through videos in the way that millions of people do every night before going to sleep. These timestamps, 4 a.m. for the DoorDash order, 4:12 a.m. for TikTok activity. Established that Zana was definitely alive and behaving normally at 4:12 a.m. This would prove crucial to establishing the timeline of the murders. According to the Leda County Coroner's determination, all four victims died between 3 a.m. and 4 a.m. from what the official report describes as homicidal violence involving sharp force injuries. However, the probable cause affidavit suggests the murders actually occurred between 4 a.m. and 4:25 a.m., based on witness testimony and the digital evidence showing Zana was active until 4:12 a.m. This discrepancy in timing illustrates how difficult it can be to establish precise timelines in murder cases. Coroners estimate time of death based on body temperature, rigor mortis, and other physical evidence, but these methods have margins of error. Digital evidence like phone records can be more precise, but they only tell us when someone last used their phone, not exactly when they died. What we know for certain is that sometime in the early morning hours of November 13th, someone entered the house at 11122 King Road and killed four people. The only witness to any part of this crime was Dylan Mortensen, and her account, detailed in the probable cause affidavit, provides our only window into what happened during those critical minutes. According to Dylan's statement to police, she was awakened by what she thought was Kaylee playing with her dog upstairs. Given that Kaylee's dog Murphy was known to be energetic and playful, and given that it was around 4 a.m. when college students might still be awake and active, this explanation made sense to Dylan at the time. Dylan then heard someone say, "There's someone here." Again, in the context of a college house where people come and go and friends visit at all hours, this wouldn't necessarily be alarming. It could have been someone announcing the arrival of a friend or explaining to a roommate why there were voices in the house. But then Dylan heard crying from what she believed was Zana's room on the second floor. This was more concerning, but crying isn't necessarily indicative of mortal danger. College students cry about relationship problems, academic stress, family issues, and countless other things that are emotionally devastating at age 20, but not life-threatening. Dylan then heard a male voice saying, "It's okay, I'm going to help you." In isolation, this sounds comforting and reassuring. Someone was offering assistance to someone who was crying. It could have been Ethan comforting Zana, or a friend helping with some crisis, or any number of innocent explanations. At this point, Dylan's brain was doing what everyone's brain does in ambiguous situations, creating the most reasonable explanation for the sounds she was hearing. Nothing she had heard so far definitively indicated that people were being murdered. Everything could be explained by normal college house activities, but then Dylan opened her bedroom door and saw something that changed everything. According to the probable cause affidavit, Dylan observed a figure clad in black clothing and a mask walking toward the sliding glass door on the second floor. This person was walking in her direction, past her door, toward the exit. Dylan's description of this figure provided to police and detailed in the court documents is remarkably specific considering the circumstances. She described the person as male, 5 feet 10 inches or taller, with bushy eyebrows. The fact that she could see and remember the eyebrows suggests she got a good look at this person's face despite the mask. The figure walked past Dylan's door toward the sliding glass door that leads to the deck and then to the backyard. According to the affidavit, Dylan watched this happen and then returned to her room and locked her door. This decision to go back to her room and lock the door rather than investigate further or call police has been the subject of much discussion and, unfortunately, some criticism directed at Dylan. But it's important to understand the context of her situation. Dylan was a college student who had presumably been drinking earlier in the evening. It was approximately 4:25 a.m. She had heard sounds that could have innocent explanations, and she had seen a person leaving the house. Her brain was trying to process information that didn't quite fit together, but that didn't necessarily spell immediate danger. More importantly, if Dylan had called police at 4:25 a.m., it wouldn't have saved anyone. The timeline established by investigators suggests that the murders had already occurred by the time Dylan saw the figure leaving. If she had tried to investigate or confront the person, she might have become victim number 5. Dylan remained in her locked room until the bodies were discovered hours later. According to the probable cause affidavit, she didn't call police that night. The first 911 call wouldn't come until nearly 8 hours later. Meanwhile, Bethany Funk, the other first-floor resident, apparently slept through the entire incident. This isn't unusual. Different people sleep more or less heavily. Sound travels differently through houses, and alcohol can affect sleep patterns. Bethany's room may have been positioned in a way that made the sounds from upstairs less audible. As the sun rose on November 13th, 2 college students were sleeping on the first floor of a house where 4 people had been murdered on the floors above them. They had no idea what had happened, no idea that their lives had been changed forever, and no idea that they were about to discover a crime scene that would shock the entire state of Idaho. At 11:58 a.m. on November 13th, someone made a 911 call from 1122 King Road requesting aid for an unconscious person. The exact circumstances of this call, who made it, what prompted it, and what the caller actually saw have not been fully disclosed by police, who are protecting the privacy of witnesses and the integrity of their investigation. What we do know is that when Moscow police and emergency medical personnel arrived at the house, they found 4 people dead from multiple stab wounds. The scene was immediately secured as a crime scene, and what would become one of the largest criminal investigations in Idaho's recent history was officially underway. The first officers on scene would have immediately recognized that this was not a typical emergency call. 4 people dead from stab wounds in a college town where violent crime is nearly non-existent meant this was going to be a major case requiring significant resources. Within hours, the scene was crawling with investigators from multiple agencies. Moscow police took the lead, but they immediately requested assistance from Idaho State Police and the FBI. A case involving 4 murder victims requires forensic expertise, manpower, and investigative resources that a small-town police department simply doesn't possess. The crime scene itself told a disturbing story. According to official statements from law enforcement, there were no signs of forced entry. This detail immediately raised questions about how the killer gained access to the house. Either the doors were unlocked, the killer had a key, or someone let him in. In a college town where many students don't lock their doors, unlocked access isn't necessarily suspicious, but it does suggest that the killer either got lucky with an unlocked door or was familiar enough with the house to know how to gain entry without making noise that would wake Dylan and Bethany on the first floor. The positioning of the victims also told a story. According to information that has been made public, Kaylee and Madison were found together in Madison's third floor bedroom. Ethan and Zanna were found in Zanna's second floor bedroom. The fact that Kaylee and Madison were together suggests they may have been talking or socializing when the attack began. The later county coroner, Kathy Mabbitt, conducted autopsies on all 4 victims. According to her official report, all 4 died from homicidal violence involving sharp force injuries, medical terminology for stab wounds. The coroner determined there was no evidence of sexual assault, which helped investigators understand that this was not a sexually motivated crime. The autopsy report also revealed that the victims were stabbed multiple times with what investigators described as a large fixed-blade knife. According to the coroner's findings, at least one victim had defensive wounds, indicating they fought back against their attacker. This suggests that at least one of the victims was awake and aware when the attack began. The weapon used in the attack was never recovered. Investigators conducted extensive searches of the area around the house, including dumpsters, storm drains, and wooded areas, but the knife was never found. This suggests that the killer took it with him when he left, which indicates a level of planning and presence of mind that ruled out a completely spontaneous attack. However, the killer did leave behind one crucial piece of evidence, a tan leather knife sheath found on the bed next to Madison Mogan's body. According to the probable cause affidavit, this sheath would prove to be the key piece of physical evidence that would eventually solve the case. The knife sheath is what's called a Kabar-style sheath, a leather holder designed to carry a large fixed-blade knife. These sheaths are commonly available at sporting goods stores, military surplus stores, and online retailers. There's nothing unusual about owning one, but leaving it at a murder scene is either incredibly careless or incredibly arrogant. More importantly for investigators, the sheath contained DNA evidence. According to court documents, Idaho State Lab forensic scientists were able to extract what they described as a single-source male DNA profile from the button snap of the sheath. This DNA would become the cornerstone of the entire investigation. DNA evidence in murder cases can be tricky. Sometimes there's a lot of it, sometimes very little. Sometimes it's degraded or contaminated. In this case, investigators got lucky. They had what appears to be clean, single-source DNA that could be used for comparison purposes. But having DNA is only useful if you have something to compare it to. The DNA profile from the knife sheath would need to be run through various databases to see if there was a match with known offenders. If that didn't work, investigators would need to use more advanced techniques like investigative genetic genealogy. Within hours of the discovery of the bodies, Moscow Police Chief James Fry held a press conference to address the community's concerns. His initial statement would later prove problematic. "We do not believe there is an ongoing community risk based on information we have at this time." This statement was probably based on the preliminary assessment that this was a targeted attack rather than a random killing spree. If the killer specifically targeted these four individuals, then other members of the community might not be at risk. But targeted doesn't necessarily mean safe, and the distinction proved difficult to communicate effectively. 3 days later, on November 16th, Chief Fry held another press conference with a significantly different message. "We cannot say that there is no threat to the community." This revision acknowledged the reality that until the killer was caught, no one could guarantee community safety. The change in messaging reflected the difficulty law enforcement faces in balancing public safety with public panic. Say too little and people accuse you of hiding information. Say too much and you might compromise the investigation or create unnecessary fear. Chief Fry's experience illustrates how difficult it is to manage public communication during a major criminal investigation. The community reaction was immediate and intense. Moscow had always been a place where people felt safe, where students walked alone at night without worry, where residents often didn't lock their doors. The quadruple murder shattered that sense of security completely. Local news reports documented how quickly the community changed. Hardware stores reported runs on door locks and security systems. Students began traveling in groups and avoiding walking alone after dark. Parents called their children at the university to discuss safety plans, and some even pulled their students out of school temporarily. The University of Idaho immediately canceled classes for November 14th and implemented additional security measures. According to university statements, counseling services were expanded to help students and staff process the tragedy. Many students chose to leave early for Thanksgiving break, which was scheduled to begin the following week. The economic impact on the town was also immediate. Local businesses reported decreased foot traffic as people avoided going out unnecessarily. Restaurants and bars that normally thrived on student customers saw significant decreases in business as students either left town or stayed home. The investigation itself was unlike anything Moscow had ever seen. The FBI established a tip line that, according to official statements, would eventually receive more than 2,600 emails and 2,700 phone calls from people who thought they had information relevant to the case. Processing this volume of tips required significant manpower. Every call and email had to be evaluated to determine if it contained actionable information. Most tips in cases like this turn out to be well-intentioned but ultimately unhelpful, but investigators can't afford to ignore any of them. The FBI also brought in specialized equipment and expertise that the local department didn't possess. This included advanced forensic tools, behavioral analysts who could help develop a profile of the killer, and digital forensic specialists who could analyze the massive amount of electronic evidence the case would generate. According to official statements from law enforcement, the investigation involved the execution of more than 50 search warrants over the following weeks. These warrants allowed investigators to search homes, vehicles, and electronic devices belonging to anyone who might have information relevant to the case. The crime scene itself was processed with extraordinary thoroughness. According to court documents, investigators collected 113 pieces of physical evidence and took more than 4,000 photographs. Every potential piece of evidence was cataloged, photographed, and sent for analysis. This level of documentation is standard in major homicide cases, but the numbers illustrate the complexity of processing a scene where four people were killed. Every blood stain, every fingerprint, every fiber or hair has to be collected and analyzed to determine if it's relevant to solving the case. The digital evidence was equally extensive. Investigators had to analyze phone records, social media accounts, app usage, location data, and financial records for all four victims. They also had to identify and analyze similar data for anyone who had recent contact with the victims. This digital forensics work is extraordinarily time-consuming and requires specialized expertise. Every text message, every social media interaction, every app notification creates a digital record that might be relevant to understanding the victim's final hours. As December approached, investigators were working around the clock, processing evidence and following leads. The DNA analysis was ongoing at the Idaho State Lab, but genetic analysis takes time, especially when dealing with small amounts of genetic material. The knife sheath with its microscopic DNA traces represented the best hope for identifying the killer, but extracting useful information from that evidence would require patience and scientific precision. The DNA profile would need to be compared against existing databases, and if that didn't produce a match, investigators would need to explore more advanced genetic genealogy techniques. Meanwhile, the community continued to grapple with fear and uncertainty. The university's fall semester was ending, but instead of the usual excitement about winter break and holidays, there was an undercurrent of anxiety about when or if the killer would be caught. The victims' families were planning funerals while dealing with unimaginable grief. They had lost their children to senseless violence, and they had no answers about who did it or why. The only thing they could do was trust that investigators would eventually find justice for Kaylee, Madison, Ethan, and Zana. Local news media provided daily updates on the investigation, but most of the actual police work was happening behind the scenes. Investigators couldn't share details about their methods or findings without potentially compromising their case, so the public was left to wait and wonder. As 2022 came to an end, the case remained unsolved, but investigators had DNA evidence, digital footprints, surveillance footage, and thousands of tips to work with. They also had something the killer probably didn't expect, advanced forensic techniques that could potentially identify him even if his DNA wasn't in any existing database. The microscopic traces of genetic material on a leather knife sheath were about to become the thread that would unravel what someone thought was the perfect crime. The digital breadcrumbs left by phones and apps would create a trail leading directly to a suspect, and the community of Moscow, Idaho, would eventually learn that sometimes predators hide in the most unlikely places. Four friends went to sleep on November 13, 2022. Only two woke up, but the evidence they left behind, digital, physical, and genetic, would eventually tell a story that no killer could have anticipated. In an age where privacy is an illusion and everyone leaves traces. Next time on Brian Koberger, how we got here, how a community under siege began to change forever, how investigators processed thousands of tips while advanced DNA analysis continued in laboratory, and how the first digital breadcrumbs began pointing toward a white Elantra that someone definitely didn't want police to find.
I can't tell you how often I hear, oh, I'm a little OCD. I like things neat. That's not OCD. I'm Howie Mandel, and I know this because I have OCD. Actual OCD causes relentless, unwanted thoughts. What if I did something terrible and forgot? What if I'm a bad person? Why am I thinking this terrible thing? It makes you question absolutely everything, and you'll do anything to feel better. OCD is debilitating, but it's also highly treatable with the right kind of therapy. Regular talk therapy doesn't cut it. OCD needs specialized therapy. That's why I want to tell you about NoCD. NoCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for OCD. Their licensed therapists provide specialized therapy virtually, and it's covered by insurance for over 155 million Americans. If you think you might be struggling with OCD, visit NoCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call and learn more. That's NoCD.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.